Hey guys, Bionabu presents the MedTech Podcast. If you're intrigued and want to learn more about how technology is changing healthcare, then this podcast is perfect for you. If you want to learn about entrepreneurship and innovation, then stick around. My name's Esh, and welcome to the conversation.
Hey guys, welcome back to the MedTech Podcast. Today I'm joined with Dr. Abdullah Albiati, CEO and founder of Medical Chain. Medical Chain is a revolutionary electronic health record platform, which is completely transforming the way we look at medical data by utilizing blockchain technology. It's making medical records more secure, instant, and easily shareable across all points of care in a patient journey. Anyone in the NHS knows how fragmented patient data and medical records are. It's just a whole mess. And so we talk about this mess and how potentially blockchain technology can fix this mess and create one streamlined flow of patient data through the NHS. If you want to learn more about blockchain in healthcare, then definitely listen to this episode. And as always, make sure you hit the follow button, like and subscribe, and give this episode a rating. Thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate it.
Abdullah, it's really great to have you. I'm joined with entrepreneur inspiration, CEO and founder of Medical Chain. Actually, it's quite a funny story. You used to work as part of the Norfolk Park team with my dad, who's an ENT consultant in the Norfolk Park area. And we spoke probably, what, it was 2021? We had the conversation where I remember finding your company, Medical Chain. I was interested in the use of blockchain in healthcare. I was doing some research and I found Medical Chain, showed it to my dad. And my dad was like, wait, hold on, I know Abdullah. And then we set up a call, a three-way call with myself, my dad, and yourself. So yeah, just briefly introduce yourself to the listeners and tell me a bit about your journey.
Sure. So I'll try to keep it as brief as I can. So I'm Abdullah Albiati. I am a GP working in Leeds. So if you're international audience, I'm sure you have an international audience, Esh, soon enough. North of the UK. As well as working as a GP, a general practitioner, I started off as an ENT surgeon. I have my membership of the Royal College of Surgeons qualifications, and I was really destined on being an ENT surgeon. And you're right, I did work with your dad. Didn't have that much contact with him because obviously he's a consultant, much more senior than I was. So I would come to him for advice now and again, but he was busy operating and I was busy doing the kind of house officer jobs that we were expected to do. That was a very good experience for me working in London, realizing quite quickly, I don't want to be a surgeon, or the lots of bells and whistles and other nice things that come along with being a surgeon didn't really hit home with me as much as I expected it compared to the workload, the stress, the responsibility, and full credit to people like your dad that continue in that field because it's not easy at all. Then I locumed as an accident and emergency doctor. So I did this at St. Mary's Hospital and the Royal London. So these are two large trauma centers in London, which was a brilliant experience for me. And then I realized that's not really a long-term solution either as a career direction. So I decided to embark on being a general practitioner. My wife is originally from the north. We had already spent enough time in London by then. So we said, we'll just do 3 years training of GP in the north, decide which is better, and then make a decision from there. And thankfully, the rest is history. Love being in Leeds, very much happy being a GP in Leeds. And I think the whole kind of GP training, being in Leeds, really was productive and supportive to what I was trying to do in my kind of entrepreneurial career as well.
Sure, yeah. It's really great to have you on the podcast. And so how have you been? What's been new since we last spoke, Abdullah?
Yeah, so been very busy. So as well as being a locum GP, so this means that I'm essentially a contractor. I work at certain clinics at certain times that suit me, and I take as much work as I want to and as little work as I don't want to. So for example, we've got the month of Ramadan coming up around the corner where we'll be fasting, and I've only taken about 10 hours work for the whole month, and I probably don't plan to take more work than that because I'd rather focus on other things during that month. So there's a real benefit of being that kind of locum GP. I'm running two health tech companies at the moment. So one is called Medical Chain, which is a company focused on empowering patients to have access to their records, and it has support and the security of blockchain technology. And the other one is a telemedicine company called myclinic.com, and we're used in over 78 countries around the world. So those keep me busy enough. I also volunteer my time as being the chair of the Royal College of General Practitioners in Yorkshire. And I also sit on the local medical committee group here in Leeds, which is like the union of GPs here in Leeds. And then even outside of this, I have other kind of entrepreneurial aspects. So I'm an angel investor in a few tech companies, which are not health related. And I'm trying to embark on growing a private practice at the moment as well, because I think there's a real scope for doing that in the UK as there's difficulties in the NHS. Where there's an opportunity, there's a business opportunity. So I'm trying to spend my time trying to build that as well.
Yeah, really great. And I think the reason I reached out to you is because obviously we'd had the conversation before, but what you're doing at Medical Change specifically and my clinic is really empowering specifically for patients. And if anyone that's in the NHS as a clinician, they will know how highly vetted patient data is. So I'm in my fourth year training, nearly final year, and already I've seen that there's literally between primary, secondary and tertiary points of care, it's all inconsistent medical records for patients all on different operating systems. And that's just for one patient. So as a result, a patient quality care suffers. And I know I reached out to you because I was frustrated at the time. This was in 2021. I was frustrated at the time being on placement and how many patients I was speaking to. And I was asking them, oh, what medication are you on? And they wouldn't know. And it wouldn't be anywhere on the system. They'd get out this scrunched up piece of paper, and there's no way to verify if what's on the piece of paper is correct, or they'd bring their big bag of medication. And so I was frustrated and I saw Medical Change as a solution. So I think that's a perfect intro into let's discussing firstly, before Medical Change, what was the problem that you identified that led you to then address that need?
So I've always been an entrepreneur of sorts, or the other kind of terminology for that is a troublemaker. So if I saw something was wrong in the system, I would try to address it and say, look, I don't think that's right. I think we should do something about it. Needless to say, it gets you in trouble and it goes against the grain, especially in the kind of big machine, which is the NHS. So I can give you examples. I was an F1 in Royal Preston Hospital in Lancashire, and I'd only been an F1 for about maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And I was looking at the rota at the time, and my name came up more often for on calls during the day, as well as on calls on the weekend. And we used to have a system back in the day called banding. I don't think you have that anymore. But essentially, depending on how many on-calls you're doing, you would get banded. So me and a group of doctors were all in the same banding, even though I was doing more on-calls than the rest of them, me and a few others. And when I addressed this with the rota coordinator, they said, we just did A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and then started that again and again for the weekdays and the weekends. And because we started with your name, being Abdullah Albia, you popped up more often. I said, well, that's not fair. Because when I'm doing the maths, I'm doing 80 hours more on call than the other doctors. And then they said the golden phrase, which you'll hear in any kind of public sector system, is that's the way it's always been. And when somebody uses that line, that's the way it's always been, something is wrong. So I escalated and escalated this, and I ended up with the medical director. And it was the medical director, me, and the rota coordinator. And again, I was just a lowly F1. I didn't even appreciate what a medical director's role was or how senior they are in the system. And I remember complaining, and I'd done a spreadsheet, and I demonstrated that this is the issue, and that if you just split the weekends up, there'd always be a discrepancy between the juniors, but at least it wouldn't be an 80-hour difference. And I remember the medical director saying to me, what do you want to be when you're older? I said, a surgeon. And he started laughing and saying, if you're crying about 80 hours over a whole placement, you know, that's going to be nothing compared to how much extra work in your own time you'll be doing when you plan to embark on a career in surgery. And I said, okay, maybe I've got this wrong. Maybe I'm so junior and so naive that 80 hours is not a big deal. You're the medical director. When should I come back to you? When's the right time? When I'm doing 90 hours more than my colleagues? I'm doing 100 hours more than my colleagues? I'm not work shy. I'll do 200 hours more work than my colleagues, but I want to get paid for it. If I'm doing all this work, put me in a different banding or give me a locum rate, et cetera, et cetera. So that's always been my attitude from day one, to be honest with you. Not that I'm taking the piss, but if something's not right, I'm certainly going to address it and highlight it. And through my career, I've learned to be a bit more streetwise. Don't do things by yourself. Try to have a group of people come with you so that you're not the only kind of troublemaker. Don't just complain. You have to always have a solution ready. So you say, this is a problem I've identified. This is what I propose we do about it. And recognize as well that the people you are complaining to have their own problems. And you're the last thing they're worried about on their mind because they've got bigger fish to fry. And I think that's the kind of energy that I used throughout my career. And really where the uptick happened with Medical Change was in the Leeds General Infirmary. So I was in cardiology by now. This is a placement during my GP training. And I recognized that the quality of the discharge summaries, so these are documents patients go home with after they've been admitted into hospital, some investigations have been done, some treatments have occurred, and now this document is produced as a summary of their journey in the hospital that goes back to the GP to understand where's my patient been for 2 weeks, what happened, and what would you like me as a GP to do, and what are you going to do as a follow-up? So the quality of this discharge summary was really variable and in a lot of instances poor. So somebody's come in with chest pain secondary to some acid reflux. Some F1, F2 has written about a 3-4 page document to go on about this patient. Somebody's come in with a really serious complex heart attack that required bypassed stents, some root valve replacement. The middle grade doctor hasn't had the time to written about 4 lines, not explained any of that stuff. And the GP is just thinking, what's going on here? What am I meant to do at this point? So I wanted to create a kind of standardized document that junior doctors could use so that when they are writing the narrative of this discharge summary, we take away as much quote from them as possible. So I spoke to my brother-in-law called Mo Tayeb, who is an entrepreneur himself. He's exited a few companies, done very well for himself as well. And I said, Mo, you know IT business. Can you help me produce this kind of website? Because I have no technical ability then. I certainly have no technical ability now. And he just said, no, I don't have time for you. Go on Fiverr.com, just find somebody in East Europe or India that will help you build a website on the cheap, and you try and do it yourself. Which, as you can imagine, was really unhelpful. I then went to my other brother-in-law called Barra Mustafa, and I said, Barry, can you help me build this website? Mo's not interested. Maybe you can help me with this. And he's a lot more kinder in general. And he said, that's not a problem. He works in IT in Sophos, which was a security company in Oxford. And he said, sure, I'll help you build it. We can do it on the weekends and I'll teach you a little bit of coding. So we created this document called Discharge Summary. The website was dischargesummary.co.uk. And essentially you would just click 55, male, attended A&E, chest pain, finding was STEMI. This was done. So there's lots of click boxes where the document's already been prepared for you. And then when you say generate, it would say this 55-year-old man attended via A&E with a STEMI. His findings on ECG, echo, bloods, troponin, etc. were. This is what he was done with. This is what I'd like the GP to do. And then there'd be the kind of warnings that always we should say to patients on discharge summaries, which we never do, which should be, if you experience chest pain again, shortness of breath, sweating, you must reattend to accident emergency urgently. If you draw ENT parallel of that, you should have a bit at the bottom of the document when somebody's left the hospital after having a tonsillectomy, a removal of the tonsils, which says, if you start to bleed, these are the things you should do. This kind of advice, it's never at the bottom of these documents. And I standardized that process. So this got used in Leeds Teaching Hospitals, Royal, Queen Elizabeth, Lewisham Teaching Hospitals as well, University of Lewisham. So things took off in that sense. And I did this completely for free. I was just trying to find a solution to a problem which I'd identified. We then had a large pharmaceutical company actually take note of the work we'd done, because it helped. The consultants could now depend on this discharge summary as a document to use in their clinics in outpatients. The GP could depend on this document as well. Now it was standardized. They knew exactly where to look for their bit. The non-clinical coders benefited the department financially, because they could say within that discharge summary was, did the patient walk with any aids? Did they smoke? Did they have any disabilities? Because these things are not relevant to us per se clinically, but they get more money for the department to show a more challenging patient we had to look after. So the pharmaceutical company said, it want you to build more of these templates for more of these departments where our medications are involved, because we know that the prescriptions are more accurate and people are adhering to what the discharge summary said. Barrow was IT. I'm the doctor. We didn't really have a business person between us. And I was not business minded at all. I was just trying to solve problems. So we went back to Mo and we spoke to Mo and we said, look, you're the business guy. Remember that idea I told you about? It's actually gained some traction, built it with Barry, and this is where we're at. And then Mo said, okay, how much would you want to sell this idea to this farm?
Is he interested enough?
Yeah, now he's interested. Money involved, now he's interested. So he said, how much do you want to sell it to this pharmaceutical company? And I said, look, me and Barry spent a lot of time on it. There's a lot of expertise that went in there. We're thinking £5,000. So Mo just started laughing at us. You're a couple of idiots. They spend £5,000 on student pizzas, Domino's in a week. So what are you talking about? And then we spoke more about business and what do we want to solve, what problems there are. And he said, if you had infinite resource, time and team supporting you, what would you want to do? And I described the idea of medical chain to him. Because I'd come from a background of surgery, I'd come from a background of A&E, I'm now working as a general practitioner or training to be a general practitioner at that time. I can see how the medical records are just siloed in different areas within the system. And one clinician has no idea what the other clinician is doing, even to the point of allergies. You could be giving the patient a medication and they know they're allergic to something, but they don't remember the name and you don't have access to those records. So So you're just playing Russian roulette and saying, okay, I hope it's not this one. Good luck to you. Yeah. In this was 2017 at the time. It's not good enough. I don't think it's acceptable.
It's still probably not good enough even now.
It's still not good enough even. At the time of recording this, we've had nurses strikes, paramedic strikes, junior doctors going on strike. The whole system is crumbling at an alarming rate.
Yeah.
Anybody could have seen. It's like watching the slowest car crash for the past. Everybody can see what was happening.
You know what's so interesting as well is you just told a story about when you were meeting with your medical director earlier, and they said, oh, that's the way it's always been. And it's funny because at the moment I'm doing a clinical audit just around discharge summaries for pediatric asthma patients who will come in with an asthma attack and then will leave. And the audit is basically showing that there's basically one in 50 patients are actually getting a good quality formal discharge plan put in place saying, oh, if this happens, if your son or daughter experiences an asthma attack, then this is a stepwise approach that you need to take to prevent you coming into A&E again. And a lot of the patients is probably about 40% readmission rate because patients that have come in previously just don't know what to do when it happens again. And so I'm working on at the moment just a really simple digital mobile storyboard app where patients and their carers can just follow, and it's just a really simple stepwise approach. This is what you do. If you're having this symptoms, try this. If this doesn't work, do this. Really simple. And I've shown it to my supervisors and all that. Literally exactly the same. One supervisor who I'm with is really great. She's helping me push it forward. But I know a couple of the other doctors who I've shown this to. It's the way it's always done. So it's interesting that, 10 years later, still the same phrase is being talked about.
It's the same wherever. We're talking about telemedicine. And for me, telemedicine is just the biggest joke. It's been around for donkey's years. Skype, MSN Messenger, Zoom. Yeah, these have been around for donkey's years. And all the people that said patients won't understand how to use it, it's too complex, blah, blah, blah. COVID came along, the same naysayers are now the champions of telemedicine. And say, I'll show you guys how to use it. This is the best way of using it. You're the numpty that blocked this in the first place. And now you've noticed there's an actual trend towards pushing towards this. You want to be at the forefront of that as well. And for me, that's a great case and example where we should have been using this technology ages ago. The benefits are overwhelmingly obvious. The biggest crisis we have in hospitals right now are waiting times, car parking spaces, and waiting rooms. You develop at least a telemedicine solution for an outpatient follow-up. Just do the follow-up. Don't worry about the initial appointment. Just do the follow-up. You reduce the load and the stress on the car parking spaces. You stop frail old people being picked up in a minibus going on a 2-3 hour round trip to pick them all up, to drop them off at a waiting room, where they're all coughing on each other and spreading infection to each other. Yeah. You help the parent at home looking after children to have that follow-up appointment and just ask those questions. It's so obvious, but what did they say? Where's the evidence-based medicine? So what do you mean evidence-based medicine? That's a six-figure investment with randomized controlled trials and all other sorts of nonsense to prove something which anecdotally is obvious. At the same time, they said, oh, but there's security, there's this. The biggest problem we have, this goes beyond the NHS, this is just basically anything really public sector run, is people don't want to find a solution. They're very quick to highlight the problems, and everybody wants to show they're cleverer than the person next to them by finding even more problems. But nobody fulfills their role, and at the end of the day, it's their job to provide a better service, to say, look, we've identified the problems. The next step, we actually have to solve these problems. We need to fix these problems. And we can't just keep sitting there and kicking the can down the road and saying that's the way it's always been and making it somebody else's problems. Your app that you're talking about now, what's the harm? I'm sure you'll be hearing the same stuff. What's the security? We need to do a trial, blah, blah, blah. It's just barrier after barrier. They're technophobic and they are really scared of any innovation. And that's why the medicine we're practicing today is the same medicine we were practicing 50, 60 years ago. And it's so outdated when you think about all the technology that's come around. But when I was at medical school, we were taught to be walking encyclopedias, learn all the syndromes, learn all the drugs, learn all the interactions, learn all the sodium, potassium channels.
Still the same.
All the same. And that was good for back then, where you had to literally go to a library and pull a book off a shelf to find that condition again. And that happened during my lifetime, because now as a GP, I sit there with two monitors. One monitors the patient's records, the other is Google. And I will open Google in front of my patients and I'll say, I don't really remember what the guidelines were for wetting the bed at night for your six-year-old boy. Let me just double check whether we should start this drug or not, or whether we should refer him or not. Google is going to have infinitely more information on it than I'm ever going to remember in my mind. My skill as a doctor is to know where to apply that information and when is the right time to go down different avenues. And again, a student now, you're in the system right now. I can't imagine anybody is teaching you that way. Again, just...
You know what? It's interesting because obviously with the release of ChatGPT, universities have had to change the way they've been examining us. Rather than embrace the fact that this is the technology that there is out there and change the way they are examining us in terms of utilizing technologies like ChatGPT, prompting the AI to obviously still know your stuff, but prompting the AI to give you a generate an answer. They're just saying, oh, let's just ban it completely, which is obviously really backwards because it's just proving the point again, like you said, that they don't want anything to do with it. They want you to be a walking encyclopedia rather than being able to know the stuff that you need to know. And then beyond that, being competent in your competencies, but then beyond that, know where to look for the right information.
It's a real shame. Essentially, it's generation after generation of potential wasted, even beyond, okay, forget about the kind of technical side, just the leadership side of things. What leadership do they teach at universities now to our medical students? Our medical students are our consultants of the future. Our medical students are our GP partners of the future. They're going to lead MDTs. Who taught them this? Who taught them how to do invoices? Who taught them about hiring and firing? Who taught them about knowing what to do with VATs? When I'm a student going through a medical school, I'm not married to this idea I have to be an NHS doctor of some kind. We'll get a medical degree, and it's up to me what I do with my medical degree and my medical career. But they try to make us so insular and so focused and so bogged down in nonsense that they don't give you the headspace to think outside of the box and to be like, look, what's going on here is rubbish. I don't agree with this. Sure. And I think we should do things differently. And unfortunately, that's why it's not hard to see. That's why we find ourselves in the mess that we are in today. You have consultants who towed the line, knew this was a problem, but thought, I'm not going to kick up a fuss. I just want to get to the end of this. And then the next generation came along and those consultants said, we did it. So you need to go through the same rubbish, even though we all know it's rubbish. And over time, that rubbish got a little bit worse, a little bit worse. Another document, another form to fill in. Need to come in a little bit earlier. Need to leave a little bit later. Your pay's not really changed in the past 12 to 13 years. Now it's breaking point. Now everyone's like, why am I doing this again? What's the point of this? And look, I'm a real advocate for being a doctor. For anybody listening to the podcast, finish your medical degree. Our company, Medical Chain, we raised $24 million in 2017, and we raised it with cryptocurrency. And that was when Bitcoin was around $9,000, $10,000. And at one point, it was over $50,000, for example. And as a company, we still hold some of that that we hadn't used in offices and everything else. So do I need to work as a doctor? Technically, no. But I really enjoy being a doctor, and I'm still a doctor. And I'm so grateful that I never lost my degree or lost my qualifications. And I would really be a massive advocate for saying you must finish your medical degree. Don't look at the NHS and say, that's my career path in front of me, and that looks rubbish. The medical degree is a massive bonus to have under your belt. And it's about how you are going to utilize that and where you're going to utilize it. That's where it will make the biggest difference.
I think with blockchain technology, the word that is used to describe it in every industry is disruptive. And I probably use that word to describe you, Abdullah, just talking today, very disruptive in terms of being very outspoken in terms of what needs to change, and rightfully so. And so what is blockchain for people listening out there?
Yeah, so blockchain, it depends which way you want to look at it. On the simplest side, it's a buzzword, which you may have read and not given it much thought. On another side, you may have read about it to do with Bitcoin, for example, which is a digital currency or a cryptocurrency, which has had a lot of flack in the media for being the currency of criminals, if you will. Again, that's its own political agenda. But coming to what blockchain essentially is, to really break it down for you, on the lowest level, it is there to remove the middleman from any transaction, because the two parties involved in that transaction can digitally and electronically and cryptographically trust each other. So I'll try to give you an example. If I'm trying to sell a house and you're buying my house, I need a lawyer to prove and to be the trusted party that I own the deeds to that house. You need a lawyer to prove as a trusted party that they've checked your finances, your money is clean, it's not been laundered, there's nothing dodgy about it. And then these two lawyers who trust each other are going to make that transaction on our behalf. And now I have your money, you have the house. What blockchain technology does, or distributed ledger technology, is I can digitally prove I have the deeds to my house. You can digitally prove the source of your funds. And you and me can do that transaction between ourselves and cut out that middleman. So how does it work? There's only three terms you need to know: distributed, decentralized, ledger. If you understand these three terms, you'll understand what blockchain is. So distributed, it means if we go back to that transaction between the house and the money, rather than having one lawyer, let's say there's 20 people in the room, and 20 people in the room are looking at our transaction and making a note of you and me and what we plan to do. Those 20 people are distributed because amongst themselves, they've not all come from the same body or representing the same group. They're decentralized because they're independent from everybody else. So essentially, they're making a decision on themselves. And there's a ledger, a book, where they are documenting, yes, I can see that's Abdullah's deed. Yes, I can see that's Esh's money. And all 20 of us have recorded that transaction. If one day somebody turns around and says, I don't think Abdullah's transaction went through. Abdullah said he never got the money. The other 19 will sit there and be like, no, we saw that transaction gone through. We all documented it on the ledger. And this idea of you formed a block of information is cryptographically secured, which means that once they've done one piece of information and another piece of information and another piece of information has come along, it forms a chain of blocks or a blockchain where the coding of each block depends on the block previous to it. So there's lots of examples on the internet. If somebody wanted to practice, if you write a document which says hello with a capital H, and then the next word along is how are you, you've essentially written four blocks of information. And that's going to be given a cryptographic code to demonstrate hello, how are you. If you just change the capital H to a small h, hello, the how code has changed because you changed how hello was written. And now the hello, how are you, each one has changed because the first block changed. And it's a totally unique chain which has been created. So where I wanted to deploy this in medicine is if I'm a patient, I want patients to be the conduit carrying their medical data with them from one appointment to another. I don't want them anchored to a hospital, to a GP clinic, to a service which says, I have monopolized your medical records. I'm the only one with access to your medical records. You need to come and see me if you want anything. If you want to go to the private healthcare system, you can, but they're starting with a blank piece of paper. Or if you go abroad, for example, they have no idea who you are. They start with a blank piece of paper. So how do you get a patient to turn up and say, this is me, this is my accurate medical records. I have not deleted anything. I've not corrupted anything. I've not manipulated any of that data. You can do that using blockchain technology because it's such a trusted system that there's no way the patient could have done any tampering to their data. And they're showing you a true read-only view of their medical records that only health professionals could have added to that block. So that's why we use blockchain technology in medical chain.
Yeah. And so the idea of blockchain where data is inputted, it can't be tampered with, corrupted, or destroyed, so it's secure. What was it about specifically blockchain, so when you were looking at all the issues that there were in the healthcare system, why was it that blockchain specifically stood out?
I think because it's the idea that you're going to unshackle patients. It's distributed, it's decentralized, you're not stuck to one system. I was trying to think quite far ahead in the sense that if I was going to create a new electronic health record system, how would I create it from the ground up? And I would create a web-based approach. So you don't have to be at a hospital, kind of wheelie desks that you use and open the software. Does it load? Is it not going to load? Has the computer cracked? It's just a web-based, very simple one. You can access it from any device as long as you've got the right password and you're on the right VPN or the right network, for example, to have that permission. So it's going to be web-based, it's going to be accessible by clinicians, it's going to be able to be read by patients, so patients have access to the medical record. One of the biggest issues we have in healthcare is keeping patients in the dark, patients not taking responsibility for their own health problems. We talk about this patient-centered care. It's just a token gesture. We don't actually mean it. Patient-centered care means the patient can see exactly what I can see. They're not needing to call me up in a GP practice and saying, what was my x-ray result? What were my blood tests? What does that mean? What should I do next? What did the hospital consultant say? And a lot of the time is me opening a letter and say, said, if this didn't work, we should do this next. And the patient says, I never got that letter. Okay, I can see it. That's what we're doing. If you really make patients the center of their own healthcare, they're going to take responsibility for their own healthcare. they're going to be a lot more engaged. We go back to what I was saying before about Google. Let them know the accurate resources. Let them know where they're meant to find that information. Let them guide their own healthcare problem. The biggest frustration for a clinician is when the patient comes along and has done nothing about their problem, tried nothing about their problem, and not given it enough time. You always want patients to say, this is my issue. This is what I tried doing. This is why it didn't work. This is why I'm with you. I'm like, great. You've given me such a starting point of where we need to go next with this. Patients, to be honest with you, half the time they're right. They'll come in and they say, I think I've got a hernia. You're right, you've got a hernia. I think I've got gout. Yeah, you're right, you've got gout. Did you look online about what to do about it? Did you realize it's not just medication things, there's lifestyle changes you can make as well? Our job as doctors of the future is to really be a partner with the patients. We are there to guide and to provide them with information for them to make a decision which is in their best interest, depending on their lifestyle. Yeah. It's not there to dictate to them and say, this is what you need to do. These are your problems. This is what's happening. And that's the old style of medicine.
Yeah, I think it'd be useful for the non-clinicians out there just to add a further depth of understanding. If we could break down at the moment how the NHS runs in terms, I alluded it to it earlier in terms of your primary care, which is obviously the first point of contact for patients. So you go to your GP in a system, let's say system one being used at GP. Let's say you get admitted to secondary care, which is the hospital. And there's a completely new operating system. So I think obviously you're probably more qualified to speak on and explaining the different systems and how currently medical records are passed through the NHS at the moment. And then maybe go on to, it would be good also if you could go on to now how medical chain is changing that flow of patient data.
Yeah, so for example, if you go to your GP practice, they'll either use a system most likely called System 1 or EMIS. There are two other systems out there called Microtest, for example, and another one as well. They're not used as often, but the idea is that if you wanted to port your medical records from your GP system onto our system, you could do that. You could request for that to happen. The idea, once you've got access to your medical records, one, you can view it, which you could do anyway on, for example, an NHS app, but you are also able to share it with other people. So you could share it with a private consultant. You could take it with you abroad. You could be involved in healthcare research or pharmaceutical companies and showing them, this is my information. If you want access to my data, let's have a conversation about how much that's worth to you for me to be involved in your pilot or whatever it may be. So this is something which we've been growing year over year. We're also talking to large companies, for example, one international ophthalmology company as well that wants to use this as a kind of health passport for their patients as well to take it with them. There's challenges. When we're in the UK, trying to do any kind of business with the NHS is very challenging and sometimes not worth all the effort. When you're talking about the private healthcare sector, a lot more benefit there. But certainly when you're trying to get through like a big company like your Bupas or your Spires or these kind of companies, they also move at glacial speeds because they've got so many different middle management people that need to sign off on things. So it's been a long journey, I would say. But thankfully, we've got these two products. As I say, one is the medical chain, and then the other one is the telemedicine one we've got as well.
You know, definitely making waves in the space and changing the way medical data is looked at. And I think what's also interesting, you alluded to earlier, the way you fundraise for medical chain is non-traditional. It's a completely different approach to where you had essentially an ICO, which is an initial coin offering. So you gave anyone who believed in your company the option to essentially buy a cryptocurrency. So it'd be good if you could talk a bit about that way of fundraising. And also, I'm quite interested in the impact that the crypto winter, so anyone in the crypto space, in terms they know what happened with the whole FTX scandal.
We've had a few winters crashed.
Yeah, a few winters. But how it's recently just crashed the crypto market and how that's had an impact also on medical chain.
Yeah, so when we initially set up medical chain, the focus was on having access to the medical records with a level of blockchain security. Entering that space, we recognize that there's actually quite a big community that are very proactive in terms of blockchain cryptocurrencies. And we recognize that we could create our own token, which is going to support our products. So this allows patients to interact with the services by using their tokens. We call them med tokens. They could pay for services. They could either use them within the system, or they could either receive the med tokens as payment for people accessing their medical records. So we go back to the pharmaceutical companies, the insurers, the health researchers, where you'd say, look, I'll give you access to my medical records. You can pay me in med tokens. So this was like a crowdfunding of sorts, if you will, not exactly, but something like that.
Sure.
And the idea is that we were selling them at 5 cents or 10 cents. And then when we actually launched and we were on a exchange, we were on a few exchanges, people could then trade them if they wanted to trade them. So we launched, as I say, quite a low value. And then we went up to about 50 cents. So people had made about 10 times the value of their initial investment with us because we were actually on a high. And this was February the 1st, 2018. Literally the next day, cryptocurrency crashed. And it took us with them as well because now there's not as much confidence in the market. And we went down. And every time we show like an element of recovery or a sign of recovery, as you say, there's another thing. So the FTX thing that happened is quite a, it's a complicated story, but it's really, really to make it simple is people gave one company their funds to look after, hoping like an ISA, this would pay them back over time. What they didn't realize is that the company that they've given their funds to was using their funds to trade and try to increase their, they're basically betting with the customer's money. When customers finally came back and said, look, can I withdraw my funds? There's no more funds left. And the whole thing collapsed. Now, this has absolutely nothing to do with Bitcoin. It has nothing to do with cryptocurrency. High Street Bank is what we faced when you had bankers which were defaulting badly on investments that didn't work out for them and led to the financial crash. But obviously, as I said at the beginning, anything to do with Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, people are very quick to criticize it. It's just greedy people doing bad things. And it's just another reason to regulate the market.
Yeah. The reason I initially reached out in 2021 and we had a conversation with my dad is just because there is a lot of skepticism in the space when you hear the words blockchain, Bitcoin, despite there being so many benefits, the technology, you get one of two people. You either get someone when they hear the word blockchain getting really excited, or you get the opposite where you hear someone, someone hear the word blockchain and they just hate on it and they're really skeptic about it. So obviously with medical chain being associated to blockchain quite heavily in terms of this actually the technology that is the guts of the company. How is it that you've been overcoming that skepticism?
To be honest with you, we haven't really been challenged on it. I think people can tell for the scams involved in that kind of industry, they've all disappeared. We started in 2017, it's 2023. We're still alive, we're still kicking, we still have offices, we still have a team, we're still part of NHS frameworks. So we've already passed levels of securities and levels of checks that we're an established company, if you will. I think the real challenge is, I draw parallels between this and the dot-com bubble. So you might be too young to remember this, but there were so many websites popping up overnight, pets.com, Amazon, eBay, as well as a whole host of others. And it was the same thing. There were these companies, and you can find good explainer videos on YouTube about this, where they were giving huge valuations to a website that had very little on it, offering very little services, but it was the potential of what it would be. And a lot of people lost their money in this kind of dot-com bubble. But the war of attrition, your Amazons, your eBays, look where they are today. And when we talk about Jeff Bezos and his enormous wealth, he's grown that over two decades. People have only taken notice of it now, but he's really been working hard at this. And for me, blockchain is the same idea, is there'll be a lot of companies involved in the cryptocurrency space where many will fall to the wayside because for one reason or another, socioeconomic problems, war in Ukraine, COVID, whatever you want to blame it on, they couldn't withstand that trauma that was happening to their company. But for the ones that do make it through, they will be the big giants of tomorrow. And I think that's already being seen with blockchain. More and more established companies use blockchain. Walmart uses blockchain. Large financial institutions are investing in Bitcoin now. You had, unfortunately, Elon Musk at some point sounded like he knew what he was doing. But now the more you listen to him and the troll things he says, I couldn't cite him as a good example of somebody that was involved in cryptocurrency. But the idea is it is becoming less of a unknown factor and more established for people of your generation, if you will. Many of them probably have Revolut as a type of banking. You can buy and sell Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies on Revolut. It's very accessible. So I think it's just a war of attrition and it hasn't impacted us because I think we already have enough credibility to demonstrate who we are. And probably the added benefit of that, I'm a doctor and I'm still a doctor. I had a clinic yesterday that I was in. So I still care about my medical license. I still want to make sure everything I do is above board. So thankfully, that's carried us in good stead going forwards.
Yeah, and I think you've alluded to it already, but where do you see in the next 5 to 10 years the future of medical chain being? And also, blockchain in general and healthcare. You can walk through the perfect patient journey.
Medical chain is hard to say because there's so many factors that a company depends on. We need a healthcare system which is up, running, forward thinking, confident, stabilized, and then they're going to look for the next big thing and try to get involved with that. I'm not describing the NHS here for you, which, as I said before, is on its knees and having lots of staffing issues, let alone everything else. So
yeah,
we can hang in there. I don't know where we will be in the next 5 to 10 years, depending on how things go, but I'm adamant and I'm confident that the way we practice medicine will and has to change. We are not going to turn up to hospitals or GP appointments waiting for them to tell us what they have on the records. We're going to have access to our records. We're going to walk around and shop around for where we want to have our services, even to the point where I've got my GP practice in the village, but I work in the city centre or I work in a different city. I commute to Manchester. I want to see a GP in Manchester on the NHS. I'm entitled to that. And there shouldn't be this issue of you're not on our records. We don't know who you are.
Yeah.
Why don't you know who I am? We're one system. So I think I'm confident that's the way that healthcare is going to go. I'm confident it's going to use some kind of blockchain technology. Whether it's us doing that or not, only time will tell.
Yeah. I think it's just with every industry. I mean, whereas the financial industry or whether it's healthcare in general, there is going to be some kind of reset where it's just not, we've seen whether it is in the NHS, doctors are going on strike, staffing issues, stuff like that, or in the finance industry with stupidly high inflation prices. Clearly, the systems we have in place at the moment just aren't working, and there is going to be a need for just this reset. So yeah, it's definitely interesting to talk about, and it's interesting to for the listeners to hear as well from your perspective, someone dealing in a blockchain company. So I think as we're closing up the podcast, you've obviously gone through ENT surgical training and then decided, which is in itself gruesome, really worked hard to get to it, and then you decided to step out of ENT, trained as a GP, and you also started your own companies, whether it is the discharge summary or the MyClinic or medical chain. So you clearly have this drive, Abdullah. You clearly have this motivation, this discipline for work, if you will. Where's that stemmed from, and what advice would you give any young clinicians, any young doctors or students out there wanting to start their own healthcare company maybe, or even wanting to find the motivation to go through the grueling surgical core training pathway, whatever it is?
So I think from my perspective, I'm very blessed to be provided with all the things I've been provided. I had a stable home. I had two incredible parents. I had three amazing sisters. I've got a very supportive and strong wife that's been with me the whole time and supported me and taken care of everything else while I'm off doing things and trying to figure things out for us as well. And recently we've had a daughter as well who has refocused my attention to what my priorities are in my life as well. So when I've had all these blessings, good health, no major injuries, no major illnesses, it's probably a lot easier for me to succeed than it is to fail. I think it'd be more of a shock if I didn't succeed than if I had failed. So I've been very blessed that things lined up for me quite well there. In terms of if you want to embark on a surgical career, I'm 37 years old now. My friends are 37 years old, and some of them are now just becoming consultants. It is a long, grueling specialty, as it should be. If I have a health problem and somebody wants to put a knife in me, I want the guy who, or the girl, to be politically correct, I want that person to be so committed to their trade that even outside of working hours, they're practicing on laparoscopic things at home in a box with a lamp. And when they're seeing me, I'm the 10,000th patient they're doing an appendectomy, for example. I don't want the doctor who is off building a health tech company talking about what are my rotor rights. That is me, and I would not be the right surgeon for that patient. And that's exactly what happened to me in ENT surgery. We were in theatre. I don't think it was your dad, to be honest. I think it was another consultant. We were doing something called a thyroidectomy, removing the thyroid glands, or a partial thyroidectomy. And they nicked one of the large arteries in the area. And the consultant said, oh, I'm going to have to fix this. This is a good learning opportunity for you to see how I'm going to fix this artery so we can continue with the surgery. Now, if I was a good trainee, this is a brilliant opportunity. The consultant didn't go out of their way to cause this patient this problem to then fix it. So now this has inadvertently happened. I'm going to learn something which I might not see every day. That's not what was going through my head. What was going through my head was, oh my God, we're going to be here for another hour. I just wanted to go home. I've got my wife at home. I've got all these other things I want to be working on. This is not the place I want to be. And when I realized I'm having those kind of thoughts about being a surgical trainee, it's not good for me, certainly not good for the department, and it wouldn't be great for the patient either if you don't have this committed person. So there are people out there that love surgery through and through, and if that's what you want to do, go ahead and do it and embark on that journey, as have my friends. They've seen my journey, they never quit, and they're graduating now as consultants in ENT and general surgery and all the rest. Saying that, they're knackered. I would argue that they look older than me. I could easily argue that I have a lot more free time than they do. So my routine is I get up in the morning, I take the little one to nursery, I go to the gym, I record a podcast, I work on different business ideas because I've got that headspace to think about, okay, what do I want to do now? Should I call the bank? I need to have a meeting with this person. Maybe I should talk to the estate agent and see if there's any other opportunities happening around. I've just got total control of my life, which for me is very valuable. What have I lost? I can't call myself a surgeon. I'm no longer Mr. Albiati. I'm not having that sense of fulfillment. And sometimes it's true, even when I'm talking to patients in GP about ENT, there is something which hurts a little bit, because I think I used to do the grommets or the tonsillectomies, and I was really looking forward to getting onto the bigger cases and the bigger responsibilities. And I've had to sacrifice that for everything else. For me, it wasn't a hard decision for all the things that I've gained. And for people out there that want to do, it doesn't have to be health tech. Don't worry about what the thing is. Concentrate on what you want to do with your time. Time is just the most valuable resource that we're given, and when it's gone. And you need to make the most of your time. And for me, that is the transformation I had in my mind, which was there's certain things, it doesn't matter how much you pay me. What's the point of having all this money in the bank account and I have no time to spend it? I've gone through a divorce because I gave my wife zero attention. My child doesn't even know who I am anymore because I'm not there for them. I don't want to be that person. I want to be the person that's there to look after my family and do things for my family. And if you can find something such as career or an opportunity which provides you a passive income, as well as you doing something which you love and you're passionate about, what more do you want? It's a great setup. And I'm very grateful that, as I say, the stars really aligned for me. That's the position I'm in today, where I don't have to locum as a GP if I don't want to. I do it because I actually like clinical practice and I like being a doctor. I like that I get to spend mornings with my child and pick them up and then have fun with them or take them swimming every Thursday. I like that if I want to go on holiday, just pick the destination, pick the hotel package, and let's just go. I don't have a boss. I don't have a timetable. I don't have a... It's just about what I want to do for me and my family. And for me, that is totally invaluable. And I wouldn't trade that for the world.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I think it just comes down to, in the end, make sure that the people out there who are listening are picking a career path that they genuinely just love. Something that doesn't feel like work. Because if you love what you do, then you're just going to enjoy it. You're going to enjoy your life. Whereas if you're feeling like, oh, I have to go into work because I have to do X, Y, and Z, then you're just not going to enjoy it as much, and you're going to be a bit more unhappy. It's what I tell a lot of people. Just people ask, why are you doing a podcast when we have medical school exams? I just say, I like doing it. I love doing it. Yeah. And just find something you love. You'll stay motivated.
The thing is, hopefully God provides us with a long and healthy life, but this is a dynamic situation. You might like something as a 20-year-old, which you're not going to want to do as a 30-year-old. And likewise, as time changes, as you go through time, you realize that there's other priorities in life or other things and other interests that you may have. And I think sometimes this is the danger of asking older people, what do you think I should do? So for example, when I left surgery to be a GP, my dad was so disappointed. I can't tell you how upset my dad was. But my son is a surgeon. That's what he used to say to me. You know,
it's a stereotypical,
stereotypical Asian dad, because he used to go to these dinner parties with his friends and he'd proudly say, oh, my son is training to be an ENT surgeon. Oh, Abdullah, come here. This person's got a problem with his nose. Come talk to him. See if you can give him some advice. I know my dad loved that. I loved making my dad proud, but I'm not going to sacrifice my life and my career, hours in the hospital, for his anecdotal 2 minutes he can tell his friends his son is a surgeon. And the substitution there was trying to make him proud about other things I'm doing and how else I could support the family and make him proud in different ways. So sometimes when you talk to the older generation, it's not that they're giving you bad advice. They're giving you the best advice that they know. And they only know this way. For example, you talk about doing your podcast, which you're passionate about. This has to start somewhere. You're going to have lame podcasts. you're going to have low volume of viewers. You're not going to have as many subscribers. It has to start somewhere. You need to try. Yeah. God knows where it will go in the end. But if you're passionate about it and you're enjoying it and you don't see it as hard work, more power to you. Keep going. You know, it's probably quite therapeutic for you and affords you the opportunity to talk to different people and ask them more personal questions you might have felt less comfortable doing over an email or a LinkedIn, for example. Do what's right for you.
Yeah. Really great speaking to you, Abdullah. And if anyone out there's listened to you speak today, wants to pick your brain a bit more, how can they get in contact?
Yeah, so LinkedIn is a very good way of getting in touch with me. I really try to support as many students as I can. So I mentor quite a few. By all means, if I can support you, I will. If I can't, I will signpost you to somebody else. And if I don't think it's a good connection for us, it's a good setup, again, I won't waste your time. So
yeah,
I have lots of people contact me saying, can I talk about this with you? I had one guy recently, he wrote me a message on LinkedIn, which was about this long. I honestly replied to him, TLDR, which is too long, didn't. And I just said, here's my mobile number, just send me a WhatsApp and we'll set up a meeting. Everybody's very busy. I can't read an essay. Just say to the point, what is it you'd like me to help you with? You don't need the whole introduction of who you are, where you've come from, the journey you've been on. That will come in time if we formulate a relationship. But if you just want to reach out, sure. You did. Just reach out. I'm more than happy to engage.
Yeah. Really great having you, Abdullah. Thank you so much. Definitely, we should stay in touch.
No worries. I should get up with everything you're doing.